Okay, thank you for being here tonight. We continue with our study about the role of the Law of Moses in the Bible and even the role of the Law of Moses in the life of a Christian. And we're going to continue to sample the law. We've looked at the circumstances that produced the Law of Moses, and we're sampling it. And if you notice in our congregational reading, because they're focused on narratives, the law sections are being skipped. So we're getting our dose of that on Wednesday night. So we'll continue to work through some of these samples and see what we're seeing. Jesse, could you lead us in a prayer as we begin, please?
Our Father in heaven, Lord, we thank you for this evening we have to come and study your word. We ask that you would be with the teachers and the students, help them to open their minds to understanding. Help us to study it and examine it in a way well-pleasing to you. We thank you for your many blessings, most of all, for your Son. And it is in his name we pray. Amen.
So we're looking at the Law of Moses in a lot of these four dimensions, because the Law of Moses is doing a lot. And so we're identifying how that the various laws connect to these different dimensions. So let's talk about, first of all, why these dimensions? Why is it that we have certainly religious guidelines, moral laws, but also things that would fall into the category of civic identity and cultural identity? Why is the Law of Moses containing all of this? Yeah, Jesse.
It's a nation.
Okay, because it is a nation.
A nation that's coming together, that's going to have to work together and deal with things within there.
Right.
So it's got to cover all the bases in a sense.
And in a sense, they're creating a society anew. They've been enslaved in Egypt for over 400 years. They've been inside that culture. Now, definitely as Hebrew people, they had some cultural practices. I tend to think that circumcision probably was passed on through them. That's one cultural marker. But to a great extent, as enslaved people, they had limitations on that. And so this is the creation of a whole new society. Okay? So let's ask this question. How is the kingdom of Christ different? I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about this, actually. Go ahead.
Christ works on individuals kind of from the inside out, and we need to have all these things within us as we live in the society we live in, but Christ did not come to affect social change or to govern specific peoples or things on that scale anyway.
Yeah, so think about the reading the last couple of days. It has to do with what grave incident at Sinai? That wasn't intended to check if you did the reading. What's the one grave crisis at Sinai? The golden calf incident, okay? What was God going to do? Which ones? Hosel. Which ones did he save out of bondage? All of them. God is dealing with them as a people because he'd made promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to do certain things for this people, this family that became a race that's now organizing themselves into what we would consider a nation, as Rick said. He is working as a whole with them. The kingdom of Christ is different. Are nations converted to Christ or people? People are. And the New Testament's very plain that to Christians, regarding the laws of the society they live in, the authorities in their society, what should Christians do? Like Romans chapter 13, obey those authorities. So, It's sort of like this. God was working with this whole people here. And that's why he's having to give them instructions and guidelines that would order them as a society. Christ pulls people from different societies at different time, through time. He's building a kingdom out of them, okay? And in a way, they're still living in these kingdoms, whether it's Japan in 2026 or whether it's England in 1592 or whether it's the United States in 1801. He's pulling people out of those different societies that have their own civic and cultural rules and mores. And he's bringing them into a kingdom where they live in his kingdom now within a kingdom. And then one day, the New Testament tells us, all these are going. And all that will remain is the kingdom of Christ. Including the United States, by the way. It's gone. Just a matter of time. And people love their countries and things like that. And there's a lot to love about the United States. A lot to love. Who would want to live anywhere else? But clock's ticking. As it is on every human nation. And this is the ultimate plan of God. Was not to create a certain nation state that would reflect his glory. But to choose a people and draw a people through Christ. Who would then form his kingdom. And they would reflect his glory. So, the gospel, the teachings of Christ, does it have commandments and laws and rules and regulations? Yeah, it sure does. It is focused on something specific, and that is a relationship with God. So these dimensions are very present in the teachings of Christ. These are not. Matter of fact, what does Paul labor to say in the books of, Romans, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, and Galatians? What does Paul labor to say about food? As well as, it's in 1 Timothy also. What does Paul labor to say about food? About what's right and wrong about food? What does he teach?
Nothing right or wrong about it.
Don't do anything to offend your brother.
There is no food that's prohibited as long as you receive it with thanksgiving, but you've got to be sensitive to the conscience of a weaker brother, and if eating before him or giving him that food violates his conscience, you don't do that. Okay? But the food itself doesn't matter. What are some huge cultural markers? Number one is language. Number two, after language, and it's probably two and three are very close, but probably food is number two, and three is clothing. Maybe clothing and music right there together. There is no stronger cultural marker outside of language than food. And one hang-up was the Gentiles hung up on food offered to idols, but the other hang-up in the New Testament among some of the Christians would have been the Jewish regulations. Those don't matter anymore. Those were cultural markers. That's why they don't matter anymore. And so, it's really important to make that distinction, that what God is doing with Israel in the Old Testament is not what God does with any other nation at any other time ever in history. And so the things that are said about Israel pertain to Israel as a nation, as a people, as a society. But God deals with other nations differently. And that's why you have to understand the difference in the Old and New Testament. I would dare say that one of the keys to understanding the difference in the Old Testament and the New Testament is what people is God working with. Well, most of the Old Testament, he's working with the Israelites. In the New Testament, is his focus on Israelites? It's with everybody. First to the house of Israel, but then to everyone. And so that's why the focus is very different. And it's important to understand that difference. Okay, let's dive back in here. And we're at chapter 21. I'm just pulling certain passages here that I think are representative. And so we won't work through the Ten Commandments. Let's look here at chapter 21. Look at verses 1 to 6. Joe, can you read 21, 1 to 6, please? Exodus 21.
1 through 6.
Yeah. Now these are the ordinances which you already set before them. If you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve for 6 years. But on the seventh, he shall go out as a free man without payment. If he comes alone, he shall go out alone. If he is the husband of a wife, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master gives him a wife, and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall belong to her master, and he shall go out alone. But if the slave plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out as a free man. Then the master shall bring him to God, and he shall bring him to the door or the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him permanently.
So hopefully you'll cultivate this practice as we're working through some of these samples. Don't get so hung up on the, first of all, details, and don't get hung up on how, well, the oddities, like the hole in the ear. What's the point of that? It's just something they did. But look for the general idea and the principle that's at work through this. So these are all laws about what? Instructions about what? About slaves. Where would you place it? What dimension? Remember, these, this dimension approach is very helpful, but there is overlap. Yeah, I mean, it really is civic. But specifically, what kind of slaves is he talking about here? That's right, Hebrew slaves. Hebrew slaves. And what's the main regulation, the first one that's listed? If you have a Hebrew slave, what?
They're set free after
7th year. Now, look in this text. How did the person get the slave?
Purchase.
Okay. I hope I'm not being redundant. I don't think I am, because we've talked about slavery in the Bible several times, but it's been in so many different circumstances, and there's been periods of time in between. And don't ask me what I preach Sunday. Oh, yeah, Jacob, I remember. But, you know, I don't expect you to remember everything I talk about. But there's basically two ways to get slaves. One is mentioned in verse 1 here. The other one, we'll come back to this later, is mentioned in verse 16. How?
Take
you take them. You kidnap them. So one is an economic process. The other one is duress, attack, manhandling, man-stealing. There is this expression in the book of 1 Timothy in a list of sins against God. One is man-stealer. Literally, it's what it means in the Greek. So slavery was an economic reality in the ancient world. Slavery of some form was an economic reality well into the modern period. And there's different forms. Even in a way, a serf was bound to the land, in a way, a kind of slave. It's coerced labor. And it's just the economic reality of the ancient world. And so the question is not so much the existence of it, but rather the regulation of it. And there are several regulations about slavery. And this is where there's a distinction. And I'm just going to dive into this. We've talked about this before in other settings. Slavery in the ancient world was not typically race-based. After all, this slave was what? A Hebrew having a Hebrew as a slave. Did you see that? It's not race-based. Most slavery in the ancient world was not based on race or racism. The other way that someone became a slave, besides an economic transaction, which meant they were born into slavery and they were handled as merchandise, or they fell upon economic hardship, or somebody near them fell upon it, and they were either sold as a young person into slavery under the control of their father, or they were taken into slavery because of debts and things like that. And so it's like in this country, if you don't pay your taxes and you steal and all those kinds of things, what would they do to you? Put you in prison. And sometimes in prison, they make you work. So this is not that bizarre, okay? But one was an economic condition. The other way that people became slaves is that they were kidnapped, and especially they were taken captive in war. That was probably the second most common way in which slaves were made. They were captives in war. So anybody know the American slave system that existed in America and eventually primarily in the Southeast? It was based upon what? Was it based upon economics? Was it based upon war? Or was it based on kidnapping? I mean, as far as how they got the slaves. Kidnapping. Now, what's interesting, and it's forgotten by a lot of people, is it was Africans kidnapping Africans and then dragging them to the coast and selling them to Europeans. But the slave system that America had was based upon kidnapping. And so it's a different kind of slavery. So there were a lot of slave defenders in the 19th century that would go to the Old Testament. Well, it was not really apples and oranges. And that kind of slave system was based upon kidnapping. Now, eventually there were enough slaves in America where they stopped importing them and they just reproduced. But you get the idea. And man-catching was actually condemned, even in the New Testament. However, sometimes people become, they get in dire straits and they end up in slavery. It's just like people today take bankruptcy. And they don't get to control everything that comes through on their check, right? And so you find yourself in an economic condition that results in some kind of restriction, either light or heavy restriction. And so Hebrew slaves were not to be kept permanently, which implies what? What about non-Hebrew slaves? And this is seen elsewhere in the law. What's that implying? Do what?
They could be kept longer.
They could be kept longer, right. So, and what do you make out there about the rules there about this Hebrew slave? How are they to be treated?
Pretty well.
Okay, there's a justice to this, right?
Well, there's a chance the guy could want to stay with you, you know? So, I mean, he's not going to stay if you're going to be really mean to him or something.
Right. They're taken care of.
Okay, so it's sort of self-policing. That if they're not well cared for, then he's going to skedaddle after so long. But if he looks at his prospects and he says, I've got it better here than out there, he decides to stay. And this is where you know, we're tainted by that American experience of slavery that now is just belongs to the history books. But relationships between among slaves and slaves and masters and so forth, it's a little different than what you see portrayed in the United States. And slaves sometimes could be very skilled people and entrusted with a lot of responsibility. What we just studied recently about Abraham and his very trusted servant, what assignment did he give him? Go get a wife for Isaac. That's pretty heavy responsibility, isn't it? So, there we go. All right, so, and there's the possibility that he can stay, and there's a process for setting that up. Now, look at the next one. Actually, we're not going to go to that one. Let's look at this. Becca, can you read verse 12 to 14, please?
He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. However, if he did not lie in wait, but God delivered him into his hand, then I will appoint for you a place where he may flee. But if a man acts with premeditation against his neighbor to kill him by treachery, ye shall take him from my altar that he may die.
Okay. What's this about?
Manslaughter.
Yeah, it's manslaughter and murder. Okay. And where would you put this? Yeah. We talked about this a little bit, the Ten Commandments, that murder has a civic dimension to it too. There's a moral dimension, but a society has to have some protection, some parameters in it. People can't just go and grab stuff. People can't just go and hit whoever they want to with a club, that kind of thing. There's an orderliness to society. Now, there's a distinction here. What's the difference? We call it murder and manslaughter. That works well. What's the difference according to this text? Premeditation. premeditation. That statement, God delivered him into his hands, that's a troubling statement. I just know we should understand it in light of the contrast. There is somebody who is premeditating the murder and lying in wait to attack someone versus somebody falling into their hands, which could be a thing of just like a heated conflict or even a situation where you're defending yourself, where they creep into your house in the middle of the night or something. But there's a difference in the consequences here based upon the premeditation. And isn't it fascinating that our law system is still set up that way today? You got murder, you got murder two, you got manslaughter. There's a couple of different elements of manslaughter even too. There's vehicular homicide, which is different. There's vehicular negligent homicide. You know, one, you usually run somebody over on purpose. You chase them through the, you know, parking lot at Ingles or something. And the other one is that it's an accident because you weren't paying attention or something like that. Yes?
We see him runs to the altar and tries to use that as a cover, but Solomon's like, no, he's a murderer. You just need to go kill him.
Right. Good example of that. Well, so, all right. 15 to 16. Can you read that, Les? 15 and 16.
And he who strikes his father or his mother shall be put to death. He who kidnaps a man and sells him, or if he is found in his hand, shall surely be put to death.
Now, what do these two regulations have in common? One's about kidnapping, one's about parents. What?
The death penalty.
That's right. They're capital crimes. They have a death penalty to them. So, again, we're talking about murder of parents, okay? And then the idea of kidnapping. We call it kidnapping, man-stealing, whatever. And I think that the kidnapping, we could probably put it down here also, couldn't we? Because people need to have, well, as Jefferson, borrowing from John Locke, they should have the right of, you know, of the three things that the Declaration declares, okay? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life and liberty means you're your own person, and you society should protect your life, kind of thing, rather than somebody just grabbing you willy-nilly. Yes.
Striking the parents also kind of fits into civic, because that makes me think about elder abuse, which is a common law we have now.
And I would call your attention, and I'm just going to reference it, the 1 Timothy 1. 1 Timothy 1, Paul is describing different wicked behaviors. And both of these are in there, kidnapping, man-catching, and attacking parents. They're both talked about there. So you're right, you want a society that respects the elders and that people are protected, that can lead the society and not be threatened. And so both of those elements are there. Yeah, Rick?
Well, in striking parents is a complete lack of respect for any kind of authority.
Wow, look at that.
I mean, a capital crime for striking your parents. And capital punishment, death penalty for kidnapping someone. I mean, that's heavy stuff, isn't it? Okay. Look at verse 18. Let's keep going, will you? Read verse 18. Down to verse 27, please. Variety of things.
If men contend with each other and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, and he does not die but is confined to his bed, if he rises again and walks about outside with his staff, then he who struck him shall be acquitted. He shall only pay for the loss of his time and shall provide for him to be thoroughly healed. And if a man beats his male or female servant with a rod so that he dies under his hand, he shall be surely punished. Notwithstanding, if he remains alive a day or two, he shall not be punished, for he is his property. If men fight and hurt a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows, he shall be punished according as the woman's husband imposes on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. But if any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. If a man strikes the eye of his male or female servant and destroys it, he shall let him go free for the sake of his eye. And if he knocks out the tooth of his male or female servant, he shall let him go free for the sake of his tooth.
All right, thank you. Listen, guys, no dentures back then. It's a big loss, okay? Right, Hannah? Oftentimes you'll hear these laws in the Law of Moses extracted and sort of used in mockery or even heavily criticism of the Bible or something. And then when people do that, they make the same mistake that everybody does with the Bible, and that is isolating things out of context. Or even if you see it in its context, you're not looking at everything else the Bible says about it, which gives a balanced kind of view. So a little bit of variety here, but basically this section's talking about what action. What's the action in every one of these cases? Right, some kind of assault, isn't it? Some kind of assault. And again, that also belongs in the civic part, doesn't it? Because, you know, we have crimes against persons and crimes against property in our society, and any society does. So what basic principle do you see running through these regulations about assault?
Hebrew slave.
Yes.
I mean, like,
or owned by Hebrew.
A whole lot nicer.
Okay.
And they would be under certain other people.
Now, okay, very good. Now look at this. Again, here's the balance. In verse 20, if somebody strikes and kills their slave, what does it say should happen to the one who strikes the slave? They're to be avenged. Now, what does the law of Moses teach about taking a life? What's the payment? Your life. But yet, if there's not permanent damage, there's no consequence. You think, oh, they can just beat their slaves and treat them anyway? No. This is what Joe's pointing out. Because according to verse 26 and 27, if you deliver some kind of serious bodily harm, what? The slave goes what?
Free.
Okay? The slave gets freed. That's not the case in most slave systems, right, Joe? I mean, this is so equitable, so just. I mean, on the surface, there's slavery, but when you look more closely, wow. There is the respect for the life of a slave. If you kill a slave, you got to pay for it with the slave, him or her, with your life. If you do permanent damage, like an eye or a tooth or something, that slave is to go free. That's a huge compensation. That's a huge loss to the master, isn't it? So do you think masters are going to just go around haphazardly knocking eyes out? No. No more than you would, you know, damage a tool or something. That's just, it doesn't make sense. It happened. That's why the law is there. It's a reality. It could happen. And what did you see there? If somebody is wounded, not the slavery one, but 18 and 19, what regulation there do you see when one is assaulted?
You got to foot the bill.
You got to pay for his time that he's down and he's not working. Now, they didn't work by wages then, typically. Some people did. But it's the idea of what work he missed, you got to provide the bread. I don't mean green bread. I mean the kind you eat. And then what about the woman who gets caught up in a fight? I mean, why might two men be fighting and some pregnant woman get caught up? Don't you hit my man, right? Or let me get a blow in. I don't know which one it was, but I said that facetiously. But what's the consequences here if the woman is pregnant and she gets harmed in the fight? Okay. Yeah. And it says life for life. So if she dies or the child does, you see that? A slave and a baby in the womb have life rights. You see that? A slave and a baby in the womb have life rights. And, you know, it's the idea of liability. And if she's harmed, maybe she's not killed or the baby's not killed, but the man can impose some kind of, you know, just punishment for that or payment for that. And then there's the eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Let's talk about that. I think it's the first time we see it, I think, so far in the law of Moses. It's repeated a few times. This is misused now. It was misused in the first century when Jesus talks about it in the Sermon on the Mount, because the scribes and Pharisees had taken this expression to define that the statement eye for an eye meant that if somebody mistreats you, then you have the right to mistreat them. And that's how it's applied today. Eye for eye, meaning I get to do to you what you've done to me. Okay? This is civic. If, let's say, two teenage boys, there's an old tree on the corner. I don't know, don't use that in Nashville. Okay, old trees. Let's say a couple teenage boys are throwing a baseball and they crack the back glass of a car of a neighbor. Okay? And the neighbor calls the police and the boys are given 25 years in prison. What do you think about that? Excessive. What would be an appropriate punishment in that case? Replace the glass. Pay for it. It's equal, you see. If two boys with baseball bats go through a parking lot at an auto dealership in the middle of the night and they bust all the glass and they bust the wheel wells and just do from bumper to bumper, they bash 80 cars and they're given a $25 fine. What do you think about that? It's not equal, right? So if you knock out somebody's eye, you don't lose your head, nor do you lose an eyelash. You lose what? You lose an eye. Eye for an eye, foot for foot, hand for hand, was communicating just fitting punishment, equitable punishment, not too light, not too heavy. That's what it was meant. It was not meant to give you personal permission to go and get back at someone in personal vengeance. When you look at this, this is involving judgment. If you look at every one of these cases almost, there's some kind of judgment that has to be made. So civil society has to make a judge. And we know that they had elders in the community and things like that. And then there's Moses. And then you have a system that is set up eventually for the Hebrews. And this is to make sure that when someone commits an offense, the punishment fits the crime.
It seems like it's always intended to be used as a deterrent. Sure. You're going to think twice before you poke somebody in the eye.
Right.
Because that's what's going to happen to you. Yeah, it should serve as that, shouldn't it? Absolutely. Okay. Rachel, would you look down and read verse 33? Let me see here. Let's go back. Rachel 28 to 32.
And if an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall surely be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall go unpunished. If, however, an ox was previously in the habit of goring, and its owner has been warned, yet he does not confine it, and it kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its owner shall be put to death. If a ransom is demanded of him, and he shall give for the redemption of his life whatever is demanded of him. Whether it gores a son or a daughter, it shall be done to him according to the same rule. If the ox gores a male or female slave, the owner shall give his or her master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned.
Okay.
I love these, the ox rules. They're in a bunch of places. And to me, they're like indicative of how the law of Moses worked, okay? So here's an ox that gores someone and kills them. And there's implication in the first case that Ozzy the ox has never done this before. Then what happens to the ox? He's killed, because once an animal does that, right? Can't trust it. What about the owner? Okay. Isn't this a civil kind of thing? We can't have oxes running around goring people. See it? And so if one's been known to do that, you got to get rid of it. We still have laws like that today, right? So, and by the way, ox is sort of a generic word that would include what we would call cattle, okay? However, if the ox was known to do this and the owner knew it, what's the consequence? He's responsible. So the ox is killed and the owner has to pay with his life. So there is a moral aspect to this, that he's been negligent, irresponsible, thus not caring about his fellow man. And you know what? There are connections between the two, right? Morality should be, I'm concerned about my neighbor. Okay, Jesse and then Joe, is that right?
Yeah. I was going to say, again, we've been talking about modern laws. You can see how modern laws have been based on this. Negligence is still a huge deal. Yeah. It's still talked about a lot.
Right? A lot.
No, I was going to say, there'd be a lot less dog deaths and dogs killing people. You know, if that was applied, because you couldn't just say, well, he never killed anybody. He's a sweet little thing. You know, he did it this time.
Right.
I mean, there'd be something to pay.
Yeah.
But there is liability. If your dog has a record of attacking people, I mean, you open yourself up. I mean, there's a recent case of the parent down in Georgia that got prosecuted because their kid was out of control and let them have a gun and went and killed people at school, I think it was, or somewhere, and parents have been prosecuted. It's the idea of responsibility, isn't it? Les, did you have your hand up? Okay. All right. I want more ox. Verse 33, Ken. Read verse 33 and 4.
When a man opens a pit, or when a man digs a pit and does not cover it, and an ox or a donkey falls into it. How far?
One more.
The owner of the pit shall make restoration. He shall give money to its owner, and the dead beast shall be his.
Okay. What do you see here? What do you think? Where is this place? Yeah, definitely. You don't dig a hole and leave it uncovered. And this is a big one. You don't dig a hole and leave it uncovered. And again, you can see the connection that you're not concerned about your fellow man and his property. And there, you know, that's the whole law, right? Love your God and love your neighbor as yourself. Don't you see love your neighbor in all of this? And I'm sure all of you have done this. You know, you've been doing something in your yard, and you're like, well, I better put this away or cover it up, or I don't want the kids getting hurt in the neighborhood or something. You know, some chemicals you're using, maybe, you know, herbicide or something, and you take it inside and put it on a high shelf in the garage because you don't want the neighbor kids getting into it. They're right up and down the street on their bikes all the time. You got it sitting at the end of the driveway. That's just being concerned about your neighbor, isn't it? Yeah, swimming pools, securing them, those kinds of things. So, yeah, okay. Let me ask you a question. Are these laws hard to understand? They're really not. I hope one of the things, it's already come out in our earlier discussions, that's coming from this study, is the law of Moses has gotten a bad rap. As if, oh, there's no way you could have done these things. Well, Paul calls it a burden that we weren't able to bear in the book of Galatians when he's confronting behavior, Peter and some others. And he's making the point that some of that regulation, a lot of it has been lifted, and it's not to be burdened, the Gentiles aren't to be burdened with it, because it was a burden even to us. But that doesn't mean that every aspect of this law was a burden. There was a cumbersome element to some of it, but I would have you see this, and we're going to work to the book of Leviticus and look at a lot of the sacrificial law, the laws of the offerings and so forth. But what group of people really had to know that law about what animal to offer, how, and when? The Levites and the priests. And they, that was their job. They were specialists. They got their living by that service at the tabernacle. And so when it, I would have you see that when it comes to the most, you know, detailed regulations, a lot of that was put on the priesthood. But that was their job, 24/7, to manage that whole operation. The vast majority of the laws, it's come up tonight, not only we can understand them, our laws are very similar to them. Les and I had a great conversation about this a couple weeks ago in the lobby. And he brought up, and I just happened to be doing mine at the time. What did you bring up? What kind of law that we deal with that's so hard? You talk about how many laws we have in our country, in our state, in our county. Okay? We're talking about taxes. And I said, yeah, I'm doing mine right now. It's crazy. Tax law is insane. Okay? If you do your own taxes, you know this.
A lot of people know this. There's 613 laws in the Bible related to Israel as a nation. And a lot of people say, well, that's extreme, you know, that's crazy. But if you were to compare it to the laws of the American nation, it would pale in comparison. Right. You know, ask Andrew.
Well, if you don't have will, yeah. But how many laws having to do with construction does Buncombe County have? 600 laws, right? 6,000 laws, maybe.
The electrical code book.
Anything they want.
Right. Okay. So we think some of this is so burdensome, you know. That kind of, no, not really. Not really. That's what we were talking about. The tax, you know, it was real easy. The tax in Israel was 10%. That's it. Okay.
Flat tax.
Flat tax, exactly. But we've got to be reasonable with this. And I want us to appreciate this. Don't you want to live in this society? I want my ox safe. I don't want it falling into pits. That's the whole thing. You want your things taken care of. So, okay, let's look down. Twenty-two, 1 to 6. Read that, Jesse. 22:1-6.
If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. If the thief is found breaking in and he is struck so that he dies, there shall be no guilt for his bloodshed. If the sun has risen on him, there shall be guilt for his bloodshed. He should make his full restitution. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. If the theft is certainly found alive in his hand, whether as an ox or donkey or sheep, he shall restore double. If a man causes a field or vineyard to be grazed and lets loose his animal, and it feeds in another man's field, he shall make restitution from the best of his own field and the best of his own vineyard. If fire breaks out and catches in thorns so that stacked grain, standing grain, or the field is consumed, he who kindled the fire shall surely make restitution.
Okay. What do these have in common? They deal with what?
Common sense.
Okay, common sense, okay. It's agriculture. It's domesticated animals that you're getting your living from these animals. The milk, the meat, the hides, the fur, etc., the wool. And the crops, the fields. Okay, definitely a civic aspect to this. Animals, okay, and crops. And this is domesticated animals and crops. But look at the punishment here. What do you make of the punishment of somebody stealing an animal? What's the restitution? Is it eye for an eye? It's more. Right. So why would it be so steep?
This is a person's livelihood, possibly. This is all, maybe all that they have. That too.
This is an agrarian-based society. And their livelihood and their way of life, that's what culture is built around these things. People who are agrarian have certain cultural rodeos. People who grew up in New York City, they don't have rodeos on the block, okay? But they do out in Montana. It's that kind of thing. So animals and crops are so important. And again, there's a moral dimension to this because you don't just start a fire and it burns down your neighbor's harvest and you're like, sorry about that. That's not loving your neighbor. And goes back to Rick's point about deterrent, teaches you to be careful with fire. But boy, what a strong punishment there is on destroying someone's livelihood or harming.
This could also have a religious aspect because they could be taking this person's offering that they were going to sacrifice that year.
Animal and grain and oil offerings. That was an integral part of their worship. Great point.
One thing that just angers me so much is when someone steals someone's tools.
Yeah, okay, yes.
Because that's their livelihood. Yes. That happened to Siobhan recently.
You know? Right. Okay. See, it's not that strange after all now, is it? Okay, yeah, go ahead, Joe.
What about catching the thief in the house at night and day? If he's in the house in the night, he has nothing good.
No business in there. Right. No business in there. And he suffers his fate. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.